Welcome to Why So Weekend, WYSO's weekly radio magazine. I'm Jerry Kenny. Coming up on today's program, ghost hunting with Community Voices producer Lauren Schaus. And Juliet Fromholt will tell us all about a new exhibit at the Dayton Art Institute. Up first, some election news. In many parts of Ohio, next week's election is all about taxes or levies to fund school districts. WYSO's Lewis Wallace reports passing new levies in off-year elections is an uphill battle.
A new tax hurts a lot more than a tax you're already paying. At least, that's what Ohio voters seem to think.
Renewal levies are like 90 times more likely to pass than additional levies.
Chad Packer is a Butler County school administrator who wrote his dissertation on Ohio school levies. He says whether a levy is new matters a lot, but the amount and the purpose of the levy is less significant in predicting whether it will pass.
People aren't concerned about what you're going to do with the money. They're just concerned about giving you any money at all.
And in a year without a state or national election, these decisions are made by relatively small groups of people. Dan Birdsong of the University of Dayton says older and wealthier people are more likely to show up to the polls.
It's skewed to the people at the kind of the higher end of socioeconomic status right now.
There will be almost 200 school levies on ballots across Ohio November 5th. 72 of those are new operating levies. Last year, which was a national election year, voters rejected the majority of school levies in the Miami Valley. Lewis Wallace, WYSO.
The school district in Springboro is asking voters to renew a five-year, 8.78 mil levy on November 5th. The levy request would account for about 18% of the school district's annual operating budget, but administrators say they're asking for 15% less money this time around. Less money means reduced taxes for Springboro residents, but that still means almost $8 million a year in taxed income for the school district, which says most of the renewal money would be used for operating expenses, some new buses, and some new textbooks. Also on Tuesday, voters in Springboro will elect three new school board members. The school district has been plagued by controversies in the last 2 years. Discussions of creationism in the curriculum, experimenting with classes on the Constitution, building a charter school in the district. All of these ideas have created problems for the Springboro Board of Education. And for this reason, a group of three candidates is trying to unseat a more conservative majority on the board. Ron Malone is one of those candidates.
I do not believe that conservative adequately describes their approach. It is more than being conservative. I'm a conservative, but there's no balance in their approach.
But school board president Kelly Coles, who is not seeking re-election, says the board has had one focus in recent years.
The school board, the one that I've been a part of for 4 years, has made decisions for all 4 years that were focused on the student needs. The data says clearly that Springboro Schools in the last several years has only gone up in academic success, down in remedial needs, and down on the price tag.
Ron Malone has teamed up with Dave Stuckey and Charles Anderson to run on what they call a more moderate platform. The more conservative candidates are David Bittner and Colton Vaughn, and only one of them needs to be elected to keep the majority on the school board. Springboro Schools Superintendent Todd Petrie says no matter what the makeup of the board is after the elections, he expects the students to come first.
I hope that we elect three people who are going to look at how we can accelerate student achievement and do it through a balanced budget. That's what I'm looking for.
Although all five candidates have aligned into two camps, any combination of the five could be elected, but Tuesday's outcome could send a clear message about the direction voters want the school board to take. This week in Politics Ohio, Emily McCord spoke with U.S. Senator Sherrod Brown about the Affordable Care Act, future budget negotiations, and more.
I'd like to start with the Affordable Care Act, and the website where people are supposed to be signing up is still obviously not working, and there are reports of people losing plans that had them, and now folks are going to be faced with this penalty if they don't sign up by March. Given that there's been less time due to these technical malfunctions, do you think that there should be an extension on that deadline?
First of all, clearly this was a terrible mistake. The White House was not prepared. Secretary of Health and Human Services has acknowledged that and taken the blame. That's still, they've got to do better and fix this. I think the decision on how much time people need to sign up will be made soon. I think that they need a little more time. I wouldn't change the law or set a different statutory deadline, but I would make sure people have enough time to sign up. So I think the White House needs to fix this, first of all, and then make that decision on how much time people are going to need to sign up.
How do you assess the role of Health and Human Services Secretary Kathleen Sebelius in all this?
Well, I think she was really good from all the accounts that I saw and read when she went in front of the last couple of days when she's gone in front of the committees. And she's taken the blame for it. She's a very good public official. I've known she's an Ohioan, as I think most listeners know, or initially grew up in Ohio. And I like her. I respect her. She needed to do better on this. I think she will spend all of her waking hours making this work now, and she should.
Let's talk about the next budget negotiations. Republican Senator Rob Portman told reporters he believes Republicans have more to bargain with this time around because he knows Democrats want to end sequestration. So he says perhaps Democrats will be willing to exchange that for cuts in mandatory programs like health care spending and Social Security. Do you see room for agreement there?
I don't understand why so many Republicans think the answer to fixing sequestration is to cut Medicare and Social Security. I hear that over and over. It wasn't seniors in this country that brought this economy down in 2008, 2009, and 2010. And I think that, you know, where we need to get revenue, we need to begin to close these tax loopholes. Oil companies, if a company shuts down in Springfield or Dayton and moves to Wuhan or Xi'an, China, they get tax breaks for doing that. And we're going to have to think about higher taxes for wealthy people instead. The Republicans are going in this negotiation saying cut Medicare and Social Security. That's how you're going to do this. And politically, it sounds good to say go after entitlements. But when they say we're going after entitlements, they're cutting Social Security and Medicare.
But in the spirit of what Portman is calling a grand bargain, do you think there would be any room for you to negotiate on entitlements?
Well, I'm always willing to negotiate, but I wish they would. It's always this in the spirit of bipartisanship, but their offers are always start with cutting Social Security and Medicare. More than half of Ohio seniors depend on more than half of their income depend on Social Security. And the Republicans have to put the issue of taxes on the table, closing tax loopholes, increasing taxes for the wealthy. Rather than do that, they say in the great spirit of the grand bargain, they would like us to cut Social Security and Medicare. And I'm open to a lot of things, but if they're not even willing to close these tax loopholes, how do we ever get to where we need to go as a country by taking it from Social Security and Medicare? And I just don't think that's the spirit of, it might be a political grand bargain for some Washington insiders, but it's not what this country wants or should have.
I want to shift gears for a moment to something that is a big concern here locally, and that is the mayoral race in Dayton. Last week, you endorsed Nan Whaley for Dayton mayor. What issues are facing Dayton right now that you think the mayor's role has an impact in what you're doing in Washington?
There's no community I've worked more closely with than the community organization, really, than the Dayton Development Coalition, and I see the difference they make in the Miami Valley. And I know from working with Nan Whaley for a number of years as a city commissioner and just kind of watching her and knowing her, that she has both a feel for neighborhoods and an understanding of people's lives, because she spends a lot of time, you know, on the street talking to people, and an understanding of sort of big picture Columbus, Washington, development issues, cooperation with both parties and with all levels of government. And that means, you know, working with WritePad. It means working with Sinclair Community College. It means working in the whole community and helping to create jobs. And I think she understands that really well.
U.S. Senator Sherrod Brown, thanks for joining me today.
Glad to be with you. Thanks, Emily.
Ahead of Tuesday's election, endorsements for both Democratic candidates A.J. Wagner and Nan Whaley continue to come in. Wagner has listed his ability to work across party lines as a key strength for his bid for mayor. Monday, he received public endorsements from independent Mayor Gary Leitzel, Republican Congressman Mike Turner, Montgomery County Sheriff Phil Plummer, and former Dayton Mayor Democrat Ryan McClinn. McClinn was not present at a news conference where the endorsements were publicly announced.
In 35 years of politics in Dayton, I've never seen as diverse a group of citizens come together to support a candidate. I am really impressed by the number of people from various walks of life who want to see this city and the region change.
Ohio's top elections official says he's worked with county boards to clear nearly all the duplicate voter registrations from the state's voter database. Secretary of State John Husted said Ohio has only 4 duplicate registrations, down from more than 340,000 in January of 2011. Husted says accurate and up-to-date voter rolls make elections more secure and efficient. He says more than 129,000 voters have updated their addresses using the state's online change of address system. Husted says close to 245,000 deceased Ohioans have been removed from voter rolls since 2011. A bill that would put new rules on minor party candidates is on its way to Governor John Kasich's desk. State House correspondent Karen Kassler reports the bill passed the House less than 2 weeks after passing the Senate.
The measure would require minor party candidates to gather signatures equal to 1% of the vote in the most recent election for governor or president, and would require that a minor party get at least 2% of that total vote to qualify for future ballots. Republican Speaker Pro Tem Matt Huffman of Lima said, because there's no law on minor parties, this bill is needed.
The purpose of the party labels is to inform the voter. Under the current scheme, there's an opportunity really to misinform the voter. And that's why rules of this kind are very important.
But Democrats such as Kathleen Clyde of Kent are suspicious of the bill's timing, since it would be in place for a gubernatorial election in which Tea Party activists have promised to consider candidates besides the incumbent Republican governor.
I stand today to oppose the John Kasich Re-Election Protection Act. This bill unfairly changes the rules on minor parties midway through the election cycle.
Republican Jim Beakey of Greenville in western Ohio said there was no reason to assume that politics is playing a role in this proposal.
While you want to make a political statement is fine, but the fact is what we're doing in the legislation is creating law that speaks to minority parties. That's what we're doing, so that everybody understands what it takes to be a minority party.
But Democrat Mike Curtin of Columbus said voters might well be suspicious of anyone who supports this measure.
The central question is, how self-interested do we want to be as the two major parties? And I would say that in the better part of our history, we were for more democracy and not less democracy.
The Libertarian Party of Ohio has promised an immediate legal challenge over the bill, which libertarians say prevents them from campaigning till just 95 days before an election, while allowing the major parties to campaign almost indefinitely. Karen Kassler at the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau.
The Clark County Board of Developmental Disabilities is asking voters to approve an 8-year additional levy on Election Day. WISO's Wayne Baker reports that the board had the same issue rejected last November.
In 2012, voters handed the board its first levy defeat since 1967. Jennifer Rouse-Culp is the board superintendent.
If we are unsuccessful in passing our levy, we will have to cut some of the folks that we currently are serving.
She says cuts would hit home care services and self-sufficiency programs for the developmentally disabled. The agency projects a near $4 million deficit next year after losing $2 million in state funding. Without new funds, people with developmental disabilities could be waiting years to get services.
We have made administrative cuts over the last 5 years so that we would not have to go back to the voter. When you've made those cuts, you're now at a point where the number of people needing services has increased and our dollars have only stretched so far.
If approved, the 1.75 mil levy would cost the owner of a $100,000 home about $62 per year. For WISO, I'm Wayne Baker reporting.
Southwest Ohio businesses have a new health care option on the table. It's called self-insurance, and as WISO's Lewis Wallace reports, it's not a new idea, but it's taken on a new luster due to concerns about the Affordable Care Act.
Self-insurance allows companies to cut out the middleman. Businesses and their employees all pay in a certain amount, but instead of going to an insurance company, most of that money goes into a big fund that covers basic health costs like doctor visits and shots. Then employers buy catastrophic insurance only for unexpected costs. Now, the South Metro Regional Chamber of Commerce, south of Dayton, has signed up to give its members access to join a national self-insurance pool with hundreds of other businesses. Chamber Director Julia Maxton says that can save them money and eliminate confusion.
It's very clean. It's very clear. It is something that they can understand.
And self-insurance cuts away several of the taxes and fees associated with the Affordable Care Act. It's also controversial. Self-insured small businesses won't be subject to the same regulations under the new law as those who go through the federal marketplace. Lewis Wallace, WYSO.
I could sleep. I could sleep, I could sleep, I could sleep. When I lived alone, is there a ghost in my house? I could sleep, I could sleep, I could sleep, I could sleep. When I lived alone, is there a ghost in my house? When I lived alone, is there a ghost in my house? My house.
It's the time of year when ghosts and ghouls are on the mind. But for some folks in the Miami Valley, the spirit world is a year-round occupation. Community Voices producer Lauren Schaus takes us to Springfield to meet Darren Huff, who left his previous job to open Ghost Hunting Source, a store that sells paranormal investigation equipment.
Well, I've been selling the equipment online for about 6 or 7 years now, and it's just gotten, you know, bigger and bigger every year, so I just thought I'd try and take the next step.
Ghost Hunting Source's showroom, located in the old Robertson building in downtown Springfield, hosts everything a potential ghost hunter might want. Darren tells me the most popular item Ghost Hunting Source sells is the EMF meter. EMF stands for electromagnetic field.
Well, the theory out there is that spirits are, you know, attracted to these electromagnetic fields. With these gadgets here, it could give you a reading if there is an electromagnetic field going on.
For Darren, providing ghost hunting equipment is only part of the job. Outside of work, Darren goes on the hunt himself with his friend Steve Worthen. Steve says the first time Darren invited him to a ghost hunt, he jumped at the chance. And since then, he's been hooked.
The 10-year-old boy in me loves being in these old deserted buildings like a Scooby-Doo cartoon.
Darren and Steve showed me some of the Robertson building's abandoned factory floors above the storefront. And even in the daylight, they're majorly creepy. As they showed me around, my headphones and microphone amplified every sound, and I was sure I was hearing phantom footsteps. Steve was quick to reassure me. It's just dripping water, he said. According to him, it's the ghost hunter's duty to be extra skeptical.
You know, I don't go, there's a ghost behind you. There isn't, by the way, you can come.
After my tour of the Robertson building, Darren and Steve said I was welcome to tag along on a ghost hunt there in a few weeks. Obviously, I was in. But before I went on the hunt, I really needed to bone up on my ghost hunting knowledge. I got in touch with the Dayton, Ohio Ghost Hunters Society, or DOGS as they're known. The group was co-founded by brothers Rob and Ed Fremder. Rob said Ed gave him the idea back in 2007.
He calls me up on the phone and says, dude, you got to see this. These guys are on TV and they've got all these computer and gadgets and all this stuff, and they're looking for ghosts. They're talking to ghosts. I'm like, well, yeah, we could do that.
When DOGS gets a request to do a paranormal investigation, they do their best to find conventional means of explaining whatever a patron is experiencing. Faulty wiring, electronics on the fritz, or even psychotropic medication could all convince someone there's a ghost in the house. But if DOGS can't find an earthly reason for your ghostly trouble, they'll come back and investigate further. Contrary to popular belief, no busting of ghosts will occur. Instead, DOGS instructs home and business owners to live in harmony with their haunts. DOGS member Donna Garwood sent me off with a piece of advice on how to prepare for the upcoming hunt.
You meditate and you open up and you ask the good Lord to protect you and don't let nothing evil get a hold of you.
On the night of the ghost hunt, the Robertson building was packed with hunters, and paranormal gadgetry beeped and clicked. Some of us headed down to the basement first and gathered around pro ghost hunter Teresa Lynch. She took out 2 mini Maglite flashlights, which she unscrewed slightly until they were between the on and off positions. She laid them on a trash can.
Okay, if there's anybody in here, spirit-wise, that would like to communicate with us tonight, there are two flashlights. If you could touch those, that'll turn them on. And that lets us know that you're here and ready to communicate. Anybody here?
We got no action in the basement, so we all trudged upstairs to one of the factory floors, which was clearly being used for storage. Among many other things, there were piles of old doors, giant streetlight bulbs, a single cowboy boot, and a jar full of liquid, nonchalantly labeled battery acid. The ambiance was spot on. Teresa tried the flashlight method again, but still no response. So she brought out a piece of equipment often used by ghost hunters, known as a spirit box. The device is essentially a badly working radio. It scans rapidly through AM radio frequencies, creating static. The theory is, spirits are able to use the white noise generated by the spirit box to communicate.
So if anybody would like to communicate with us, if you'll just talk. Hello? How many years did you work here?
10.
Thank you so much for your answers and communication.
It looked like things were heating up. We got some more chit-chat from the spirit box, and even what sounded like a name, Robert. But the talk petered out, so another ghost hunter reminded Robert he could still use the flashlight to communicate with us.
The flashlight.
The flashlight switched on. I could barely believe it. Teresa asked the spirit to prove it was really there and turn the light back off.
Turn the light back out so we can ask questions. Thank you.
The light just turned out.
For sure. We can be positive and for sure.
So, what did I hear and see at the Robertson Building? Did the spirit box really transmit the thoughts of a ghost? Or was it errant chatter from talk radio or a trucker's CB? Maybe the vibrations of our footsteps made the flashlight engage. Maybe I didn't hear or see anything. Nevertheless, everyone I met was kind and fun, and I had a great time. And as I got into bed later that night, I imagined a man named Robert, forever destined to walk the lonely factory floors of the building where he had once worked, hoping for a night like tonight, when someone might walk in and ask his name.
The Shankill Butcher's on the rock.
For WYSO's Community Voices, I'm Lauren Schaus.
You're listening to WYSO Weekend on 91.3 WYSO. I'm Jerry Kenny. Thanks for joining us. Objects of Devotion is the Dayton Art Institute's newest special exhibit. It features over 60 alabaster sculptures that were originally displayed in homes and churches in medieval England. Objects of Devotion is being paired with Wings, a modern sculpture exhibition by Elizabeth Turk. WYSO's Juliet Fromholt spoke with curator Amy Marcero de Gallen in the gallery ahead of the exhibit's opening last week.
Tell me a little bit about the idea of devotion in art as we see it in this exhibit.
I think the first half of the show with the alabasters is definitely what people most often think about devotion in terms of a sacred context. So you have 60 carved alabasters that speak to Christian themes, that taken right out of the Gospels. And so definitely it is a sacred context and people that would pray to these objects and use them as tools or aids for their worship. But it's the theme of devotion is so much broader than this, and it encompasses so many different forms that take it beyond the secular, the sacred rather, tradition, which is why we paired this show with a contemporary artist, Elizabeth Turk. A series of her work called Wings, our monumental sculptures of wings, the artist conceived on the eve of the millennium. Our education department has also constructed a guide to items in the permanent collection that speak to the ideas of devotion. Other religions, but also things like ancestral portraits. I mean, that's another form of devotion, a family devotion, or an African worship figure. Again, speaking to how broad this theme of devotion can be.
In pairing the alabaster objects and Elizabeth Turk's work, was that an easy connection for you to make when you were putting this exhibit together?
You know, when I think about the types of things I pair, I love pairing contemporary work with older work, because I really want people to connect to something, and if they can't find a connection in this body of work, I wanted to pull them forward and say, you know, this is a theme, again, that is just ubiquitous, and artists today are still struggling with it. People are struggling with it. I just really liked adding, ending on a question mark. I followed Elizabeth's work for years, and so I knew of this body of work, And when I realized I was going to bring the alabasters to Dayton, I thought this would be a perfect companion and a way to end the exhibition.
And we are very lucky to have the alabasters here in this community.
Certainly. They are from the finest collection of these in the world, the Victoria and Albert Museum. You will not see this number of alabasters or this quality in any museum in this country. So really, it's a rare opportunity to come down and see 60 of these carved alabasters from the finest collection in the world.
And along with the alabasters, there are pieces from the permanent collection and then some really wonderful manuscript pieces that are on loan. Can you tell us about those?
Sure. Supplementing the alabasters, we have 9 medieval manuscripts and books from a local collector, Stuart and Mimi Rhodes. These books are just wonderful examples from the period, including an early copy of the Golden Legend, in which a lot of the stories of the lives of the saints directly come out of. We have the earliest English Bible in private hands from around 1260, page from the Gutenberg Bible. I mean, just things that you do not find everywhere, and the fact that they're in a local collection and from a collector who was willing to lend makes it all the more exciting that we've got these paired in the show. We've also added some items from our permanent collection, a few of our sculptures and prints and drawings, and a tapestry to round out the experience.
And this is a great exhibit for around the holidays when we're sort of reflecting and thinking. But these pieces are both contemplative and highly dramatic.
Drama is definitely a great word. I mean, it was all about the drama. These pieces, you have to remember, were intended for people who could not read. And so the stories had to be very clear. The drama was definitely heightened. A lot of the scenes of the martyred saints, for example, a saint who would have been pierced with arrows, Saint Edmund or Saint Sebastian, literally would have had arrows sticking out of the bodies. And so this drama is just really high. The level of carving, they would have been seen in candlelight. So the drama was, I think, central in the minds of the carvers. Some of the other imagery comes out of medieval mystery plays, again, drama being the core there. And these alabasters were basically, tools for worshiping, but also tools for showing you what could happen if you didn't worship. So drama, again, central to these.
In talking about that these pieces a lot of times would have been seen by candlelight, you are creating an atmosphere within the exhibition with some scenic elements and lighting. Tell me a little bit about that.
Sure. We're always mindful. As a curator, I'm really mindful of the context of objects. When you take it out of their original context, which you do when you show anything in a museum, I think it's important to try to recreate as much context as possible. And so we paired with a local scenic design company called Scenic Solutions right here in Dayton, and they do set design for places all over the world. And we were fortunate to be able to pair with them and give them some elements from Gothic cathedrals, and they constructed archways. Many of these alabasters would have been seen in churches, Gothic churches, so we have that element within the show. We've also had very dramatic lighting, and our designers, Martin Pleiss and Eric Reith, have gone above and beyond, I think, and really working to create an ambiance. We've got a chapel and home, because these objects were also seen in individuals' homes, and an actual chapel from a church that we've recreated with a reproduction window from the Ely Cathedral, which is a cathedral in England. And we'll have Gregorian chant music that will be piped in to the chapel. So I think that it will be an experience to see these in a similar context that you would have seen these back when they were produced.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Juliet Fromholt speaking with curator Amy Marcereau de Gallen. Objects of Devotion and Elizabeth Turk's Wings are on display now through January 5th at the Dayton Art Institute. That's it for this edition of WISO Weekend on 91.3 WYSO, Yellow Springs, Dayton, Springfield, and online at wyso.org, a community service of Antioch College for the Miami Valley and beyond. Coming up next on WYSO, The Book Nook. We'll be right back.
This week on American Roots, it's the flamboyant style of Ernie Cato, the R&B emperor of New Orleans, famous for the song Mother-in-Law. Then a tribute to Professor Longhair, with original recordings and a concert featuring Dr. John at Tipitina's, the New Orleans club named after Longhair's best love song. I'm Nick Spitzer. Join me for American Roots from PRX.
Coming up this afternoon at 2 on your public radio station, WYSO.
Uno, dos, tres, four.
¶¶